earlier in the year.
Hello. If you've never seen crossbills, now's the time. Visit any pine wood, the bigger the better. And look to the tops of the trees, listening for their zipping calls as they feed on the pine seeds.
For more than 30 years, Eric Hardy brought the sights and sounds of the countryside right inside the homes of BBC Radio Merseyside listeners. For more than half a century, he introduced conservation and environmental issues to readers of the Liverpool Daily Post, and both to local naturalists who joined him on walking excursions and to night school students who learned from this very special tutor. He was the icon who helped to develop and share a passion for the living world. It was a remarkable career that spanned 8 decades. I had the pleasure of working with Eric Hardy and getting to know him in the last of those decades. I saw him once a week, every week, for nearly 10 years. At first, he seemed a curmudgeon, and worst of all for me, intolerant of women. But slowly and surely, we developed a friendship. I came to appreciate his vast knowledge of the countryside, and he in turn recognized my genuine interest in what he had to say. Always a modest man, Eric Hardy claimed not to have entered the world with any great talent, but to have inherited an interest in plants from his uncle, who was a naturalist in the Midlands.
I wasn't born with a brilliant mind like one famous fellow who said that in his cot he had picked up a piece of straw and said triticum vulgare to his nanny. I didn't have a nanny. I started with an uncle, a well-known Midland naturalist at the time, Turner, my mother's sister, brother, and he took me at the age of 8 collecting mainly moths and butterflies and bird watching. That was my beginning. And he was the old-fashioned naturalist. He was largely a collector. But my botany was learned as a youngster over the wall in Smithdown Road Cemetery, long before I studied academic botany. And I learned a lot of my zoology with poachers trapping rabbits in the grounds of Carnatic Hall. The main thing was to keep one eye open over the wall for the policeman doing his rounds on the bicycle.
Eric was always fiercely proud that throughout his long working life, he didn't enjoy the certainty of a full-time job, but instead earned his daily bread as a freelance, writing, broadcasting and lecturing on subjects he knew and loved inside out. Unlike most other nature writers, he had no other day job to fall back on in lean times, and when he told the tale, he couldn't resist a typical Hardy-esque swipe at authority.
I had to earn my living from the start. My father was not a member of the city council, so I couldn't get a job on the corporation or connected with it. And when you're freelance, you've got to pay for every pencil, every stamp and envelope. But the nature writers then and now, in a very different position, on The Guardian, Coward, a friend of mine, who wrote the Guardian Nature Notes, was a senior partner in a bleaching and dyeing company. Boyd, who succeeded him just after the war, was a yarn merchant on the Manchester Exchange. It's very easy to write when, as Boyd, before the war, was driven around in his chauffeur-driven car. I went round on a bicycle, even if I went to Cottrell's Clough on the velocipede, and then I'd stand up all evening at home because I was too sore to sit down. I had to buy, my first typewriter was second-hand. It was an old flat-topped Empire with a rubber band to keep the space lever working, and that was bought from a well-known shop in Liverpool in the evening after the boss had gone home, because it was cheaper when the boss had gone home than when he was there. I didn't inquire why. And all my books were second hand. The big bookshop at the university now, the very big one in Brownlow Hill, started as a second hand bookshop in Hawke Street at the back of the Adelphi, and I used to get my books there. And from Dawson's, a second-hand bookstore at the back of the market. And I used to collect medicine bottles, wash them out, and I used to get 1 in 6 or 100 in order for money for my books. But this was typical of most people of those days.
Eric's ambition to become a specialist writer was formulated during his early school days in his home city.
When I was a kid at Lawrence Road School, I was educated very cheaply on scholarships. And when I was at Lawrence Road School, before my city scholarship up to the Holt, I used to write the nature notes in the school magazine. But my ambition was to be a freelance naturalist, whatever the way of getting my income, walking around, pleasing myself where I went, what I studied, just like the old naturalists, and by various means, journalism was the opening that enabled me to earn a living.
And initially, at least, that turned out to be a regular job with the morning newspaper for Merseyside and North Wales.
I was 2 years with the Daily Post. That was 1930. I've been writing for them for some time. They had ambitions of turning me into a crime reporter. There was a noisy park in the countryside, but I wasn't interested. I wasn't interested in that.
Eric spurned the shackles of an office-based staff job, preferring the freedom to explore and report on his first love, the countryside. That meant developing a host of contacts from whom he could derive freelance commissions. His flair for original reporting, his vast knowledge of the subject, and his idiosyncratic style ensured that those commissions kept coming. Together, we would bemoan falling standards in newspaper writing. He loathed what he called scissors and paste journalism, where press releases full of jargon would be regurgitated with no original thought.
At the same time as writing in the local press, more or less a gift from heaven, I got the contract, what they used to call plums in those days, to write the nature page in the new children's supplement in the Queen newspaper, which was the posh society magazine, a glossy weekly called The Queen. Whereupon I no sooner started writing that than from Bond Street I got letters in very posh notepaper, linen paper, asking me to go down and have my photograph taken alongside the society people, Lady Semolina Rice Crispy or somebody, merely because I wrote in a society magazine. Naturally, I didn't comply with that. My ego didn't rise to it. And I also wrote for one of the provincial suburban papers, which was my first bad debt. The usual thing that freelance journalists suffer. But a great friend, I owe a lot to Ernest Hope Prince, who was editor of The Echo. He started as a reporter on the Warrington Examiner. In the bad old days, he got £1 a week as chief reporter, and he had to take down in shorthand a full sermon Sunday morning and Sunday evening at the parish church. All the papers carried the vicar's sermon in full in those days. That was the hardest. He had a great friend, and so was Johnny McClay, the editor of the Daily Post. They put up with a lot of criticism from him. I'm a very critical person. I can't keep quiet when there's a racket going on. I'm a bit outspoken at the wrongs and injustices of life, particularly regarding nature and wildlife. They were very tolerant and very helpful. O'Neill on The Observer, the features editor in the early 30s, was a great friend. I wrote a fortnightly column in The Observer, for which I got 3 guineas, 3 times the fee I got the Daily Post and The Echo.
Eric was best known throughout his life for his interest in plants and birds, but he claimed a much wider interest in the living world and always wanted to promote that enthusiasm via the press, radio, lectures, and personal contact to the widest possible audience.
I'm interested in all life. Life is the most wonderful thing in the world. How it began, how it changed, and opportunities are used for beds are easier than plants. A lot of my plant interest developed during the war when one of my colleagues, I was in signals, in the Army Pigeon Service and later in General Signals, and our wireless officer and I worked together and in the war, but also in the field. And we used to go out collecting plants when the others were just getting drunk. And this is a lifelong interest in botany. We worked with Americans and Russians and world botanists in the Old Jerusalem Naturalist Club. My botany upgraded a great deal then. But I'm not just interested in recording plants. I'm interested in opposing the closed shop in natural history. And I've argued everybody who listens to my programmes or reads my articles has as much right as I have to enjoy this thing, providing they don't harm them, providing you mustn't collect or destroy plants. I would never collect or destroy a site. But by hell and high water, if there was a bird nesting somewhere and I wanted to check that, I would check it. It wouldn't harm it, but I'd get in, legal or illegal. And also, everybody has equal right to study. I've been over 50 years a tutor with the WEA, the Workers' Educational Association. Everybody has the right to study, but that means disciplining their minds. And this is one of the troubles in life today. We've got the herd instinct in a place like Liverpool, where everybody thinks alike because they don't think at all. And people interested in natural history, photography, art, music, who can think for themselves. They're not the people who break into banks. And very often the people who break into banks, youngsters, are not bad, but they've got into bad company. So I'm always feeling if I can use my influence to help people who are underprivileged in natural history, who haven't got the influence to get to privileged places or to see rare things which are kept for the privileged few, then I will open the window, a new light to them, I'll open the door to them and help them.
It was fitting testimony to Eric Hardy's prodigious outpouring of knowledge and wisdom that he was entered in the Guinness Book of Records as the longest-serving natural history contributor to a newspaper. We've already heard an intriguing reference to Eric Hardy's war career as a signals officer, a war which took him ultimately to the Middle East. Eric operated in the Army Pigeon Service, which provided a secret and reliable means of communication behind enemy lines. During the Second World War, the Royal Signals maintained more than 150 pigeon lofts, both in the UK and overseas, though the history of using birds to carry messages goes back somewhat further.
The pigeon corps started in the Indian Mutiny. The main thing about pigeons people don't realise, in these days of wireless, and of course we use wireless, and they're not secret. Anybody can tap into wireless. You can't... in the war, we couldn't send Japanese signals by any way. There was no Morse for Japanese signals and maps. And finally, we were dropping pigeons into the Low Countries where agents kept them in lofts. They were shot by the Germans if they were found. And they used to draw maps of the V-bomb sites, put them in a pigeon. And our head, Wing House, was in Piccadilly. Wing House, that was the headquarters of the Pigeon Service. But on D-Day, the landings, it was a terrible weather on D-Day. And the Yanks, as usual, when the Yanks came over, I'm not anti-American, we all pull their legs. Their pigeons, their army signals, was their signal corps, had no pigeons. They had a pigeon service without pigeons, and we stocked them with pigeons, and all our pigeon work was top secret. But immediately the Yanks had got our pigeons. They got photographs in all the newspapers standing with pigeon lofts. These are famous American pigeons, and they were British bred pigeons. But on D-Day, it was terrible weather, and one of the portable wireless sets were on things like hand carts run off the landing gear, and they were under the water. And in wireless broadcasting, you've got to get all your sets netted on the same wavelength. It was terribly difficult. And the first messages over were pigeon post, both the army signals and press association, war correspondent. The first message were brought by, on D-Day by pigeons in the bad weather. And the interesting thing is, because being an ornithologist, I was concerned with this. I wasn't over on the invasion. I was in the Thames estuary as pigeon officer controlling a lot of the work. And... the main thing was the pigeons went up the coast from Normandy and crossed to Calais. Now, this is what migrants do. They won't cross the broad water. Birds, land birds avoid water if possible. And on D-Day, they crossed to Calais. We worked this out from the timing they take. We know the speed of pigeons and the weather, and we can estimate the routes of pigeons very accurately. And we knew they'd gone up to Calais and crossed there to Dover and then got up to Wing House in London that short way. Short way over the least amount of water. It was very interesting. But pigeons are secret, and we had them in the desert, and the long-range desert patrol that went behind Rommel's lines to cause nuisance, they used pigeon communication. It had to be secret. Before D-Day, all the minesweepers clearing the channel, they had to have pigeon communication to be secret. On Dieppe, when the Canadians went over Dieppe, I supplied the pigeons, went down to London, loaded them on a ship, and I had to make sure the pigeons were last loaded, otherwise the NAFI would put their rations on top. And when it got to Dieppe, they wanted the pigeons out first. They were very widely used. And, of course, in future war, a pigeon is not affected by tear gas like humans. The RAF and the army used them most. The RAF had them as, again, wireless silence, two with each aeroplane. Most operations were short range. It varies with the work. And it was very interesting training these pigeons, some to fly at night, to a small light, some to fly in two directions by feeding in one station and watering in another and separating these baskets or stations further till they fly 30 yards and then go back. At the siege of Tobruk, the British were surrounded there and they were enclosed there and the communication had to be by pigeon. So we had what was called a nomad system, a pigeon basket that the pigeon had used at home had a big white cross on it. and this was put out by the troops in no man's land, and a pigeon was released by an aeroplane above, or two for security, for duplication, and they go straight down to that marked basket. They were trained to go into a similar marked basket for food in this country. And then the British would pull in the basket on a cable and read the message or put the reply in and let the pigeon go, and it would return back to its home loft. This was some of the specialised work, which was very, very fascinating, because I was interested in bird navigation. And we had beam radio at Catterick in Yorkshire, in touch with America. And I used this to test homing. Pigeons released under beam radio weren't affected at all. It was very interesting, much better than training human beings. You see, we had a set course, and if the pigeons didn't pass this course, we rang their necks. So the pigeons were only 100%. Now, the unfortunate thing with troops, if they couldn't fire a rifle straight, you weren't allowed to ring their necks. Many teachers would like that method in Liverpool today, teaching the kids.
When hostilities ceased, Eric found himself in the Middle East and became involved in establishing the Army Education Service in Jerusalem, an opportunity too good to miss to evangelise about wildlife.
I've been interested in education all my life, the right to study natural history, the right to study anything. And in the Army, education was a bit of a... It was over-publicised, but it was a bit of a racket. And well, one officer said to me, one colleague said to me, look, I don't believe in this army education. These chaps are going to compete with us for jobs after the war. They're going to get better jobs than we have. Well, and I said, it doesn't matter. They have as much right as we have. But in addition to running the Jerusalem Naturalist Club, which was an international organisation, I started army education, and I was education officer for East Jerusalem Zoo, and had over 3,000 troops and Indians, Sinhalese, and so on. And, of course, a great deal of natural history. I had my own private zoo. In fact, a lappet-faced vulture was sent by me to the London Zoo using the aeroplane that was conveying the American Palestine Commission of politicians. We did a lot of very original work there. Very original work. In fact, a lot of our work at the Dead Sea was by the caves where the famous... scrolls were found. They were there. It was only an Arab shepherd who just threw a stone in at a dog in temper, and he heard it hit something strange, and he'd broken one of these clay flasks.
Service in Palestine brought fascinating discoveries like that one, and the fun of running a personal zoo. But then, as now, this was a turbulent part of the globe, and Eric Hardy considered himself very lucky not to have become a casualty of violence.
I once was in streets of Jerusalem on the edge of the light and dark, as the countryside's pitch black, and I was listening to jackals and one or two other things, and I still got this sense of anybody near me. I suddenly sensed somebody behind me, and I swung around. There was an Arab. He was going to knock me on the head with his knobkerry, he's going to steal my revolver. I was there when the King David was blown up, and we had our signal office there, and the film that was done the other year was entirely wrong. It was just made up by somebody who hadn't got the real information. It happened in the morning, not the afternoon, and I was putting on an exhibition of bird skins for the Jerusalem Naturalist Club, and I'd been arranging it, and I suddenly found my driver and truck missing. So I went to our signal office, in through the basement of the King David where it was, and I saw these milk cans. I thought, it's damn silly, somebody putting milk cans here. So I went through to our signal office, chains were up, an arm guard on, and only because they knew me, they let me in from there. What had happened, the woman had gone into the British Airways, this wasn't in the film, she went to the British Airways office and asked, she said, I think she said a suspender had come undone, and to embarrass the British assistant, so he said, could she adjust it? So she said, oh yes, you can stand behind the counter, and he went into the room, and she planted the decoy bomb. That had gone off. My colleague, with whom I'd only recently had breakfast, was shot and killed. He was our cipher officer. And these milk cans were full of TNT, and the fuse was burning, only I was too thick to see it. And while I was phoning to find where the my truck had gone, my colleague on the other phone was phoning General Darcy to tell him that the cipher officer was shot, terrorists were in the building, and I just moved outside, and the whole side went up, and got 20-odd, and we dragged out. And the first casualty I dragged out was an army sergeant who was a Jewess, and she had a leg blown, smashed up by Jewish terrorists. This is what they don't realise. We had a lot of Jews who were loyalists with us, and both Jews and Arabs were killed. It was a great tragedy. But the building went up because it was very cheaply built. There were bricks filled with rubble. But that is the way they built in the East.
On return to Civvy Street, Eric resumed his freelance writing career on Merseyside.
I edited a couple of magazines from home, two bird magazines, After the War, Wild Birds, and Nature magazine, Nature Lover. And it was very interesting work indeed. But there is a limit to what one can do, and my trouble is I've spent too much time outdoors to develop the indoor side. I should have spent more time working indoors, but people don't realise finding birds and rare plants. You don't just go out to Ainsdale and find a mass of rare flowers, or go to the Orme and find a mass of rare birds. The amount of time you put in relation to results, is enormous. One other attraction of being outdoors is it enables one to get a satisfaction for a feeling of independence. You can stretch your mind in the countryside after all the worries and anxieties. And although I don't own any estate, only a family grave, I've probably had more out of Knowsley Park than the present Earl or his uncle who was Earl before. I've been privileged, I've been given access to the park for natural history studies, and this applies to very many private estates. And I often go around these private estates, and mentally, I virtually own the estate and know every inch of it and the plants and the birds. And I very much appreciate that. And this is what we fought the war for. And this is why those of us who are ex-servicemen, I argue, have got as much right as anybody else to argue for the preservation of the Mersey from a barrage, to preserve the dunes from development, to preserve birds from rare birds from being shot, plants from being pulled up and destroyed. Conservation, I always believe, is an ownership that the public share. And if the public, I feel, like me, know these plants and birds, they feel that it's part of their countryside, and therefore they have a right to argue against great capital and big industry for the preservation of these places. I used to say to the troops during the war, I had to put on British Way and Purpose lectures twice a week, British Way and Purpose and ABCA to the troops, and I used to say, we know what we're fighting against, but we don't know what we're fighting for until we get home and see that our colleagues who didn't get home are not let down. Rupert Brooke and all that. Yes, we had a poster, an army poster of a woman and a child walking up the Yorkshire Dales, and it said, worth fighting for. Then we come home and find the Duke of Devonshire owns all that area, or the Duke of Sutherland owns 2/5 of England, isn't it? And we're debarred here and debarred there. Usually because war profiteers have been able to invest their aircraft share returns inland. One island in Scotland, the Western Hebs, Outer Hebs, we couldn't land because some very rich man had bought all this island for his own residence. That's wrong, I believe.
For Eric Hardy, it was no 9-to-5 job. Most of his day was spent out in the field or back in his home office writing up his findings, leaving not a lot of time for conventional family activities.
He used to always come round on a Sunday, usually for lunch, and I would always remember him arriving at the house because he'd always put his finger on the doorbell and leave it on the doorbell until you came to answer the door, so it could take... It was a hellish din. That was Grandad.
Paul Gilston, Eric's grandson.
Now, he'd always ask what we were doing at school and throw maths questions at us and ask us what we'd learnt, but he was... As everybody will know, he always flew about everywhere. He was never, you could never pin him down to one place. And of the times when I remember going to Eric's house in Woodsorrel Drive, I remember sitting in his office and being totally amazed with all the antlers and the heads of animals and all his books, numerous books. And with his, and I always remember picturing him in his chair with his green visor on, busy typing away, which he always seemed to be doing when we went there. I could never quite understand him being out on the moss in the howling gales and rain looking for one particular animal or bird, and I just couldn't quite see the enjoyment out of that personally. I used to go out there quite a bit with him when I was a younger lad, you know, when I was 8, 9, but I soon lost interest in it. I didn't quite find the fun side of it, really. I wouldn't say he was a really close family man. He was always outside wanted to see what was going on and the latest news and what was happening in and around Liverpool, really. I don't really remember that much of him as a family man to myself, but he was always there for us and supporting us. We occasionally went fishing together 2 or 3 times once I joined the local fishing club. And he would spend more time up and down the banks looking at the flowers and the rarities there than he would concentrating on the fishing. So, yeah, it was good fun, though. He learnt me a lot.
James Posnett, a Cheshire farmer who got to know Eric Hardy getting on for 50 years ago, spoke movingly to a packed congregation at Eric's funeral about his friend's life and achievements.
So polite yet forthright in his beliefs that everybody should see all things in nature. He had no secrets and would always tell you whatever you wanted to know. His knowledge was boundless. His first troubles were from Smithdown Road in Liverpool, where a drop-handled bicycle was his mode of transport. On this he would carry his field glasses, notebook and typewriter. For visits further afield, he would go by bus or train with his bike, always outdoors seeing nature in the raw, wearing his beloved brown army greatcoat.
How did James Posnett get to know Eric Hardy?
I think he was brave enough to give him a tinkle on the phone, to be honest, because he was always keen watching birds, and he was so approachable, and he liked to help you all the time. And when I'd spotted any interesting birds, I'd always give him a tinkle, and sometimes he'd really delight me when he put my name in the paper, which was in the Countryside articles. I thought that was the bee's knees.
Eric Hardy was a man for all seasons and a man of many dimensions. Eric published his first book on birds in 1941 and wrote many more, including two books on the birds of Palestine. He founded the Merseyside Naturalists Association in 1938, and it continues to thrive to this day. He won three medals for his wartime service, though never used his rank of captain beyond the war years, because of his enormous disdain for titles. And away from the countryside, there was another side to his life. He was a life governor of the Imperial Cancer Research Fund since 1974. Always a man of strong principles, Eric Hardy credited his mother with setting the standards which he followed in his professional as well as his personal life.
I was brought up with a strict upbringing by a mother who was very strictly the old Church of England die-hard Tory, but she had the very good principles of the difference between right and wrong, and I couldn't be a party to an untruthful statement. Many journalists say it's nothing to do with me, I'm merely making money, and I know a lot of nature journalists invent their stuff. This is a fact. Now, I've been in trouble all my life for a principle. When I first used to write, for the first 30 years, I used to keep secret the sites of rarities. When I was with the Echo, if a rare bird was in the area, I used to arrange with prints that nothing went in the news about it for a fortnight. But I got criticised by malicious people as being unreliable, lacks detail, and so on. And it became necessary to prove one's statements. But a lot of journalists will write a very good Henry Williamson's Tark of the Otter. All imaginary stuff. He's not gone out and seen a particular otter. Now, with my writing, I have to prove everything I say is truthful. Therefore, I mention the place I've been to, and on radio, the people I've been with, and everything can be proved. Because I know it's quite honest, I suppose, and they're often friends of mine. People who write nature articles indoors, and they take their ideas to the country. They can write a very graphic article about a kite soaring over the Welsh mountains. They don't tell you which mountain. One chap, for instance, a well-known writer, he's dead now, so I'm not libelling him. Wrote an article in the Sunday Times on red kites in Wales, and this was all written in the RSPCA office in Newton, Wales. He'd never seen a kite in his life. But to read that article, you'd think he was watching kites. Now, when I write about kites, I will mention that I was standing outside the post office at Coombe Istwyth. So you can go there and ask the postmaster or his wife or something, was I there? Or I'll mention the farmer at Top Farm at Kirby, Top House Farm at Perimeter Road. He was talking to me on the phone. And I don't carry stuff that's been printed before. I very often get circular letters, press handouts, which I don't use because they're in all other newspapers. Everything I write is original. And that's the standard I've aimed at.
As an academic, Professor Tony Bradshaw of the Merseyside Environmental Trust regards the natural world from a slightly different perspective to that of Eric Hardy. Nonetheless, he pays tribute to Eric's unstinting work in sometimes far from perfect habitats.
The thing I remember so much about Eric Hardy is that he was a person who was, as a friend said to me, one of the most outstanding all-round naturalists he knew. But the thing is, he was more than that, and that was the thing I found when I first came here, that he was a naturalist who was not interested in just nice, clean, pure environments. Now, I say that because my own background was very much, the only places I was ever taken to were nice, clean, beautiful places, no pollution or anything like that. But Eric just went on showing us the natural history and the wildlife growing in particularly the Mersey Estuary and other human messed about places that we're all familiar with. And this, I think, is really one of the most important things, because he made us value particularly the Mersey Estuary. And I think I often wonder what would have happened if he hadn't sold it to everyone. And of course, the end point of that was that the Mersey Estuary became not only a site of special scientific interest, because people realized that that's what it should be, but also a Ramsar site. And a Ramsar site is a wetland of international importance. It's named after the place where they had the conference in Turkey to decide to do this. And so the Mersey is really a very special place. And I don't think it would ever have been labelled like that if Eric hadn't sort of beaten up enthusiasm, sold the place to everyone. As a result, of course, a lot of work has been done on the site on the Mersey, and it is a very, very interesting area. And of course, it's now much cleaner and, in a sense, much nicer. But he worked on it when it was really filthy. A friend of mine went up and congratulated him when it became a Ramsar site, implying that Eric could take the credit for doing that. And the interesting thing is, he didn't really seem to want to take the credit. And I think he was, in that sense, although a vigorous person, quite a humble person, and in a sense, I get the feeling he really didn't want to take the credit, because it was the animals and plants that should take the credit for coping with this environment.
Farmer James Posnett became infected with Eric's enthusiasm and was a regular companion on excursions into the local countryside. He retains very fond memories of their times together.
I enjoyed quite a few trips, but the majority were to Frodsham Skaw with our great friend Ron Allen from Western Runcorn. That was a real adventure. You were on a very wild place, and provided you were rugged up well, you saw nature just as it should be. And there was a unique insight into a fantastic area for birds, Mount Manistee and Stanlow Bay. Such wealth of bird life, well, is still unique today. And another trip I did with to Leighton Moss a few years ago was also very rewarding, because on the way there, he knew everybody when we went on these country roads, all the farmers, he knew them all by name, and his memory was completely unique. He knew everything. Anything you wanted to know about nature, he'd tell you. Incredible memory.
Bob Hughes, Bob the Birdman, echoes the view that Eric did not seek sanitised environments, but derived pleasure from finding wildlife flourishing in sometimes less than attractive surroundings.
Amongst bird watchers and naturalists at an amateur level, we knew the sort of good places to go, and we did. And they weren't all, you know, the pretty places like Hilbury or Sefton Coast, Ainsdale, Frodsham.
for instance, was a favourite place next to ICI, and it was a terrific place for waders. Shotton Steelworks, these on the Dee Marshes, these were some of the interesting locations that you ended up in. But they were not designated as any sort of official reserve, as far as I can remember. It was in these early days of my own, 1957-58, that John Gittins, for instance, was just setting up the Hilbury bird ringing station. So that's how we were in the, you know, the very beginnings, the infancy of organised nature reserves, if you like. And as far as I remember, the only nature reserve at that time was the nature reserve at Manistee at the end of the Manchester Ship Canal at Easton, which Eric almost single-handed, I think, had inaugurated shortly after starting up the Merseyside Naturalists Association in 1938, I think that was, out of the Liverpool Field Naturalists Club, I think it was called before that.
The Mersey Estuary and Merseyside doesn't seem a great place to be interested in wildlife.
Tony Bradshaw again.
That's where I relate to him, because I found it fascinating that his interest was mainly, was particularly in animals. So he had this enormous, and birds, but he had this enormous breadth of knowledge. And mine was more in plants. But I mean, when I came, I found it every bit as fascinating as he'd been selling it, which was very good.
His lectures to the Merseyside Naturalist Association were very fulfilling for. And I'm sure a lot of people gained a lot of knowledge there, and also all the field trips, because they go all over the northwest, various places by coach.
James Posnett.
He'd show you things that you'd pass by, and, you know, a larvae or a butterfly or a bird, you know, an insect. I mean, he just knew it all. It was incredible. And this was the knowledge you gained from him, and he didn't push it out you, but if you wanted to learn, he was there for you, and he never failed. He never failed me. He was wonderful.
Eric Hardy's Countryside programme on BBC Radio Merseyside began initially as an extension of his activities with the WEA, the Workers' Educational Association, soon after the station opened in the late 1960s. But Eric's connection with broadcasting and the BBC goes much further back. As a schoolboy, he made regular visits to Liverpool's very first radio station, 6LV, which provided a pioneering, if short-lived, local service in the late 1920s and early 30s.
My brother, Harold Hardy, was 10 years older than I am. And he was a leading light in the Liverpool Wireless Society, which was largely the backbone of 6LV. And the whole staff of 6LV in the arcade in Lord Street consisted of a male announcer and Muriel Levy, the woman announcer. And I was in 6LV Radio Circle. I've still got the badge, which was a group of schoolboys who went down there. And my brother got me in. And on a Saturday afternoon, we cheeky little brats, promising juvenile delinquents, would be in the one studio they had, talking through the mic to the rest, or shouting through it to the rest in the other room. And it was very enjoyable. In those days, as right up to the war, there was, and the mic was on a stand, like a hat stand, and it hung in a great band of cork to avoid vibration. And you didn't sit down, you stood up to give your read out your script. And it was done live, there was no taping. Later on, they used to make some discs of after the war, before tapes came out. Tapes have been a godsend.
Small stations like 6LV gave way to a regional system of programming, and Eric began broadcasting about natural history with the prestigious BBC North regional service from Manchester in the mid-1930s.
I did a program on the Blue Cap Inn at Hartford in Cheshire. It was an inn named after a Cheshire Hunt hound that won a race. And that was the story of it. I had done some public lecturing then, for a few years, but it's an experience that's quite novel for the first time. Muriel Levy would stand, when I used to give broadcasts from Manchester, waving her arm round if you were slow, wanting to speed up, or putting her hands up and down if she wanted to slow down, you were going too fast. She was a great character, a great help too. They all were.
But it was also terribly formal. You had to be rather posh. What amused me, there was a woman once giving a lecture on, I think, Palestine. She'd never been there, excepting on a Cook's tour for a fortnight. And she turned up at the studio dressed like a Red Indian. She'd bought some Arab clothes. They were all out of order, she was wearing. She was wearing these for a radio broadcast. It rather amused me. But the staff were always dressed very formally in case some dignity from the council came along. And they had to grovel.
At Radio Merseyside, Eric's weekly programme became a permanent feature of the schedules. Staff remember fondly how week after week he would arrive with a closely spaced script produced on his ancient typewriter, or tripwriter as he used to call it, but would then begin a series of phone calls to capture the very latest news of bird sightings or the appearance of rare plants. As a result, an already difficult-to-read document was rendered practically indecipherable. This would cause me no end of problems as he arrived for his live gardening advice spot in my programme and thrust his trademark notes into my hand just as the microphones went live. He led me down the garden path many a time with unchecked typographical howlers on air. Natural history it may have been, but Eric was arguably not the world's most natural broadcaster. Nonetheless, his enthusiasm for his subject more than made up for any deficiencies in the delivery, though Eric was typically self-deprecating about his performance.
I'm afraid my problems are that I talk too quickly, I haven't got a refined enough voice, and I'm not conversational enough, and sometimes perhaps, I hope I'm not, but I'm perhaps sometimes opinionated when I shouldn't be. I'm told by my producers here, I must think there's a pretty little girl on the other side of the table, and I'm talking to her. And over the years, this pretty little girl's got a glass eye, one tooth, she's got a wig on, and she's got a face like a witch. And that is the trouble.
After we had recorded his weekly gardening broadcast, Eric would set off on foot to deliver his column at the Daily Post offices. It became a ritual smiled upon by newsroom colleagues, as he would, eventually, allow me to do up the jacket buttons his arthritic fingers struggled with, and to nag him about wearing his scarf. He made an incongruous sight, striding amongst the office workers in Old Hall Street, in his country walking clothes. Eric Hardy was an imposing and distinctive figure, and a highly respected source of information on wildlife, not least in the days before websites and telephone information lines. Bob Hughes recalls waking up to nature in the 1950s and 60s and his first encounter with this slightly forbidding and revered character.
I was in the local school Natural History Society and we had a field trip out to Hilbury Island, and we were just setting off from West Kirby in our small short-trousered group, and another group was heading back away from the island, and one of the older boys in our group turned to me and almost whispered in a very dramatic voice, "That's Eric Hardy." Now that tells you, I think, how famous he was, even at school level. You have to remember, of course, the days we're talking about was well before computers, and the source of information was limited. Often you'd have to wait a year till you saw the annual bird report. And Eric, the articles in the Daily Post, first of all, and then, of course, the Radio Merseyside broadcasts, they were more or less the only source of up-to-date local information. Today, of course, we've got websites and hotlines, telephone lines, but in that respect, Eric was a real sort of icon. It was almost a spiritual experience to sit down at the radio and listen to his weekly report.
Eric could be a slightly daunting figure, too, even to family members. His grandson, Paul Gilston, again.
He'd always speak his mind. He wasn't scared of shying away from a situation. He'd tell it how he thought it was and take the consequences on that. You're always wary of what you said to him, and he always made sure you were on your best behaviour, because he didn't like you to make lots of noise. You know, your children, you're meant to be quiet and in the corner and only spoken to when you spoke.
Though Eric Hardy was best known as a commentator on wildlife, he also appeared on radio to talk about gardening, often enjoying the challenge of dealing with phone-in questions from listeners. The soil was a long-standing interest, going back to his formative years.
I started gardening on my father's allotment. He always said I started by falling into the water butt. That's not true. That happened later. But I had a plot of my own. I was an inquisitive naturalist. The only trouble was I used to grow plants and was too impatient for them to mature. I used to pull them up to see how they were getting on. But I started in George Bernard Shaw's description of a gardener, a perambulator of a muck cart. My father gave me tuppence a week, and other boys had the same, collecting any manure in the streets for the family allotment. Then that was when I was about 8 or 9. Then when I was about 10, I had my strip where I cultivated. I don't know whether my mother found them edible or not, but I cultivated a few vegetables, grew radishes and the like. And I did literally fall in the water tub because I was trying to pull out a water can so full that it was heavier than I was. But I had an allotment. The problem has been with work. I've always been interested in growing plants as plants. I don't grow the biggest aspidistra in the world or a marrow with a figure like Epstein's Genesis. But gardening is another interest in life. Plants are living things. Extremely fascinating, and we learn as much botany in the garden as amongst wild plants.
Eric's countryside companions put their total trust in him, though James Posnett does recall a mishap one day on Frodsham Score.
He was helping a certain lady come up from the dinghy, and the job was a bit slippery going, and poor old Eric finished up with the lady's glove, and he watched the lady disappear down the bank. So it was all hands to the deck then to retrieve her.
Eric continued his daily forays into the countryside well into his 80s. He never owned a car, and his travels were conducted on foot or through use of public transport. Only in his final years did he feel the frustration that an ageing body could not keep pace with an active mind. And arguably it was his daily regime that contributed to his longevity. He was a great enthusiast for fresh air and exercise, while his spell in the military contributed to his interest.
Kit, 2 hours battle kit, and finally the commando test of 10 miles in 1.5 hours in full battle kit. But I admit I was pushed in. Another chap and I, we were over 30, we were pushed in. At the end, it was right to the limit. But yes, it's a great thing to be healthy and to breathe fresh air. Open the windows in buses, and then somebody shuts it. So you open it again, then they slam it. So you put your stick in so they can't shut it. Instead of breathing the breath of other people, all these tobacco ash of people who want to give you everybody else cancer. No, fresh air and exercise. I used to walk into Liverpool when I was young to the lectures I used to go to at the Royal Institution and elsewhere. But then it's normal for people. We found in the army that people who were fit were much better. Many unfortunate chaps died in the army because they weren't fit. A young officer in the Czech army was once talking to me, and he said he was one of the survivors because the Czech army had to do a forced march when the Germans overran Czechoslovakia. And he'd always been fit. And he was one of the fit people who managed to escape into France, eventually to England, but a lot were overrun by the Germans. And the POWs had a terrible time in those days.
His army career stood him in good stead. I mean, he was a fit man. I mean, he was a very tall figure, always strode out and with a stick in hand and field glasses and that. And the great army greatcoat, the leather greatcoat, that was his hallmark. But he never wore a cap. He was very, very strong, and he never bothered with a cap at all. Oh, you couldn't stop him. He was keen, and that's the great thing about being interested in nature. It encourages you to learn more every time you go out.
Eric had a bluff and hard exterior to many people, yet he was sincerely sympathetic to the problems and hardships of others, and he was extremely helpful to those genuinely seeking knowledge. A widower who married a second time, he was heartbroken at the early deaths of his two wives and his only daughter. He retained a sense of humour, though, and liked to give his birthplace as USA, upstairs in the attic. His favourite joke was about wildfowlers coming off the marshes, asking if there were any ring-necked duck there, and on being told there were not, said, "Oh dear, I think we've just shot the vicar." As Eric's career drew to a close, Many people felt he deserved official recognition for his enormous contribution to understanding of the natural world. But Eric hated the cult of personality and resisted all attempts to bestow any kind of honour upon him.
That was Grandpa, really. I mean, he just got on with what he did it to the best of his ability. It would have been nice if he'd been honoured for what he'd achieved and what he'd got, you know, done for everything, especially for Liverpool. But it really wasn't him. He was the man, and that was... He didn't really want all this recognition and, you know, publicity. He just wanted to get on with what he wanted to give to people from Liverpool.
Some people are just modest and they don't want it, you know. They're just quite happy to do their own things, and they won't have it, if you know what I mean. So some people just paddle their own canoe, and it is a pity in a way that they aren't given maybe an honour, but Eric will never be forgotten, that's for sure.
Just months before he died, Liverpool City Council opened the Eric Hardy Nature Reserve at Clark Gardens in Allerton in South Liverpool, a nature trail through what was once a hospital refuse tip. Housebound, sadly, during his final months, apart from regular trips to hospital, he never explored the area dedicated to his life and work. But it serves now as a memorial to an extraordinary character who served his readers, listeners, and students so well. How many other people's work spans 8 decades?
You just had to mention the name, and it was all ears. What was the information? What was the latest news? Certainly respected. I mean, I think in many ways he was also a controversial figure, but that's not negative. Yeah, there's in my short history, so to speak, on Merseyside, there's been quite a lot of local rivalries, I think you could say. I mean, the geography of Merseyside is quite fascinating because it can unite, but it can also divide people. And that was, he was a central figure, and he did his very best, I think, to coordinate all the information, you know, and irrespective of who was involved or what their background or situation was, he just wanted the information. He wanted to know what was going on, not only on Merseyside, but he seems to have covered a huge area. I think the one word to sum it up, in my recollection, is just energy. I don't know how he did it.
I didn't realise, as with him on the front doorstep sort of thing, you take it for granted. I didn't realise he was such an icon to everybody, really, in his profession. I knew he was very, you know, it was the top of his, of what he did. But I never realised there were so many people that followed him.
Yeah, just a superb man. A great mentor to me. He just showed me how much was there just for the asking. And I shall never forget him.
I perhaps one ought to say I found him sometime a person who wouldn't suffer fools gladly. One had to be careful as an academic to I think he was interested in you as a person and as a person interested in natural history, and status I didn't think really mattered too much, but he left his mark as just a unique naturalist.